Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Our goal on Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. And that's my standard intro, but it could not be more appropriate than it is today, because we are going to talk today about net neutrality, what it is, why does it matter? Because for a lot of us, we've been hearing it in the news media, but we have no idea what we're looking at. So we're going to talk about that today. In December, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, voted to roll back what was referred to as the net neutrality rule of 2015. This occurred despite 5 million comments that they received, of which 99.3% in some way or inference supported remaining with net neutrality, and the FCC, on a vote of 3-2, decided to rescind net neutrality. It's basically a principle of how internet services providers provide access, and we're going to get into a lot of stuff. This is one of those nerdier, techier programs that we've had, but I have to say that there is by no means any reason to not pay careful attention, because it may affect a lot about what goes on in how you receive and share information. My guests today are Jeff Buckingham, who's President and Chief Customer Officer of Digital West Networks, and Joshua Erdman. Is that okay? Okay, and he's the CEO of Systems and Marketing Solutions. Jeff and Josh have both been with us before on programs dealing with tech issues and communications issues. I've known both of them for a while. I've known Jeff for longer than I think Jeff wants to think about, but he and I have been colleagues in a number of different environments. Never business partners, and that's something that but I've been a customer of yours, and you've been a customer of mine, and that goes back a lot of years. I guess for kind of full disclosure, it's good to get that out of the way so people won't say, oh, you can't give Jeff a fair shake because you've known him too long. And the answer is I can actually give Jeff a fairer shake because I've known him too long. Anyway, but we're going to talk today about net neutrality, or some understanding of it. And this really is in the category of please pay careful attention, because there may be more technical information here than you want to think about. But the reality is it's just the way in which you do or do not have access and privilege to see and hear the things that you expect to see and hear. It is a call-in program. If you'd like to call in and be part of this discussion, the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And for some of you, this is a broken record, but I still have to mention it based upon the way things generally go, and that is we'd really appreciate it if you want to call and be part of this discussion, that you not wait until about 6 or 7 minutes to 2 to be part of doing that. So we'd encourage you to be part of that as early as you can. Okay, so who do we look at first? How in the world do we define what net neutrality is before we even talk about what happened to it in December?
Right, and this is Jeff, and I'd be happy to take that. First of all, I'd like to say,
by the way, Josh ducked under the table when you said you'd take it, so that's fine.
Well, first thing I'd like to say is net neutrality, I think, is actually a fairly simple thing, and I like to look at things in their simplest form so that it's not too complicated. And here's how I see net neutrality. You know, for many years, the internet was made up of lots of small companies, and we all operated on the principle that all traffic was equal on the internet. So now, granted, you may have a slow connection at your home, or you might have a faster connection at your home, but the way that that information arrived at your home, it was all equal. And that served everybody fine for a long, long time. Where we got into trouble, I think, with issues about net neutrality is we ended up with a number of telecommunications / entertainment companies merging and merging and merging and merging and getting so large that they started to say, hey, wait a minute. Now that we are such a big part of the world of the internet, instead of just charging our subscribers for their internet access, we could actually start charging the people that send information to the internet, such as Netflix, Amazon, Google, you know, and others. We could charge them and get paid twice. So right now we're getting paid once. We could get paid twice. But and where we got into trouble is they actually started to do this. Now, they will often claim publicly that they never did. That's not true.
It was an
There's
accident.
Documented cases where they have throttled traffic unless a company is willing to pay more money to get their traffic to reach the eyeballs of the customers of these large organizations. Now, companies like ours and Digital West and the companies that I've worked with in the past, none of us are against net neutrality. We all support it. So when the news says, oh, the ISPs aren't against, you know, want to kill net neutrality, they're only talking about a small number of companies, you know, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T,
Charter,
yeah. Companies like that. The vast majority of the rest of us all support net neutrality and always will.
Because I walked in the room expecting you, Jeff, to be the one leaning towards the fact that you have to have non-net neutrality because it's for your business. It's a revenue stream that you'd like to have.
No, and we're really not even in a position. Even if we were, if our principles would have allowed us to do that, which they do not, we're not in a position as a competitive company in San Luis Obispo. If we went to, you know, Netflix and said, oh, Netflix, you have to start paying us extra money, you know, for people to, you know, for people to be able to receive your content, they just laugh at us. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't do that as a small company. You can only do that if you think you control the world. And there's only a couple of companies that have that market power due to, you know, in my opinion, a lack of antitrust enforcement that has allowed companies to concentrate, you know, really too much market share to where they can exert market power that in a competitive market they could not do.
Okay. Prior to the program, when we were sharing some information back and forth before as we sat down and started to prepare for the program, I mentioned that from a business, even though I consider myself rather left-leaning in the overall world, from a business standpoint, I was saying, gee, why would you have to tell a company that they're not entitled to charge whatever the going rate is? And the example I used to Josh, and I'll let him answer the situation in a minute here, was, well, if I can afford a T1 line, and that may not be the fastest thing anymore. I'm just an old fart, and I realize that is it. But I'm thinking from a T1 line standpoint.
We're making allowances for that part
okay,
of you.
Okay, so you can define what a T1 line really is now. Okay, but that used to be the fastest way that I thought that you could get data,
right.
Versus just having a shared bandwidth on my telephone line or having bandwidth on a cable line. So the person who's going to pay for the T1 line is entitled to faster speed because they're paying for a bigger highway. And now I'll get out of the way and Josh will tell us why I'm full of crap. Okay.
So in today's world, probably a good example would be fiber, especially in the cities that are lucky enough to have Google Fiber. They're getting gigabit speeds, which is mind-blowingly fast. So if you 20 years ago were paying for a T1 line, everyone's jealous.
Are you telling me that only 19 years ago they didn't exist, but 20 years ago I could have a T1 line? Okay, go ahead. All right.
So you expect to have some extremely high speeds.
Okay.
Where the frustration would be is when you know how much speed you're getting, but in today's world, the Netflix video you're trying to watch is still low quality, but you have plenty enough speed to show 20 or 30 simultaneous Netflix videos on all the TVs in your house at full high definition, but you don't see that quality and you're frustrated. You're paying for high speed service, but the data's not coming to you at high speed. And
it's being throttled at it where it enters the provider's network.
Yeah. So you give a phone, you do some tests, or Netflix, what they did to help explain this, they put in some little troubleshooting tools inside their Netflix software that was embedded in TVs and computers. And they could say, well, the problem is your internet is plenty fast, but we aren't able to get and pipe the data into Comcast or Charter fast enough. And, you know, we talked about money, the opportunity for an internet provider to get double paid, once from the consumer and once again from the provider. But there's also another motive. It's not just about getting paid twice. Look at it from a cable company's perspective. Their bread and butter for their entire existence has been selling television subscriptions to channels. And usually you can't buy an individual channel. You have to buy a giant package and get the sports package and then the HBO package. Now their revenue in because they've stuck in that kind of model, not allowing people to have a cafeteria plan, choosing the channel they want, and they haven't innovated. At the same time, I'm still stuck seeing only the movie that's on HBO at the time it starts. I can't start when I want to. So it's another lack of innovation from the television providers. Netflix has taken advantage of that innovation. People love the fact that they can binge watch anything and start whenever they want to, and the television providers are seeing a significant revenue drop, not in their internet service, but in the subscriptions to television. So there is another motive, because there's lost dollars due to their lack of innovation on how to get content to their providers.
So the balancing act that the major providers are trying to go through, the technology is there for them to still basically send everything. If they have found a method – it's, I can't think of a better word. They're looking at something I have to call a protection racket. If Mr. Businessman, if you want your customers to be able to come in the door and feel safe and not get harassed by our people on the way in the door, you've got to pay us to make sure that we're guarding the door for you. That was the protectionism of organized right. crime well, in the 20s and 30s.
And let's call it the oligopolis, but okay. maybe we'll call them the small number of large companies okay. that are support the repeal of net neutrality. What they want to do, you know, they go to the content providers, you know, companies like Google, like Facebook, you know, provide all the content, and they want to charge them at that point. That's where the discussion gets into raising the price for the consumer, because in theory, if, you know, Netflix had to pay extra money to reach you, they may be in a position where they have to pass that along to you, to their customers. Now, we don't know that they are or not, but that may indeed happen. So when there's a discussion about how repealing net neutrality could cause the price of internet service to go up, that's really what they're talking about. It's not so much that the price that my company charges our subscribers would have to go up, because it wouldn't. But and it, you know, ultimately, it could cost the end user more, because they're paying. They may be paying the same for their internet connection, say to Charter, but their Netflix bill might go up, their Amazon bill might mm-hmm. go up. They, you know, Facebook might have to start charging for service, or raising their advertising rates, or you know, it's gonna the costs have to be paid somehow.
In a free market society, though, the argument is that people pay for what they get. Mm-hmm. And if they want to get something that's not readily available to them unless they pay for it, they just pay for it. I mean,
sure.
Example, okay, I don't get cable television because I choose not to have cable television. I just don't watch right. television.
As he says with okay. great pride.
Okay. Now, I watch a lot of movies on television, but okay. and I watch most of them still on little plastic things that go in a slot. But I'm sorry, that's okay. Not too much VHS tape anymore. Anyway, but the ability to do that, somebody's entitled to charge me for that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But let's look at another analogy. Josh loves analogies.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. Okay, the internet isn't a completely private enterprise. Okay. Companies like my company, Digital West, Charter, AT&T, we use public rights of way to build the network.
So a term that comes to my mind is you're a common carrier.
Correct. Okay. We're all common carriers.
Okay. Which is one reason why they divested AT&T of a lot of smaller companies about 40 years ago and then let them for some reason buy them all back about 10 years ago.
Right.
But I'm still not sure about that one. That's maybe a different program.
But, right. Yeah. But the point being, you know, that with common infrastructure that we all use in our society, we have rules of conduct to ensure that it works properly. We use roads. And we have speed limits and traffic laws on roads that we observe for the good of all. You know, there are rules on all kinds of things. So that for the airwaves, for the radio station that we're on today, all of these kinds of resources have a structure within which they operate that allows them to operate in the way that is of the best service to the public. Now, and I'm saying this as a guy who owns an ISP, that's totally fine with me. I understood that when I got into this business. I'm happy with that. We at Digital West don't have any problem with that at all. So part of, you know, we were supportive of net neutrality all the way along. Those final rules were finally passed in 2015 only because they kept getting overturned by the courts. You know, the court basically said, look, FCC, you can't require net neutrality to be enforced the way you want unless you actually take over total control of the internet to do it. The FCC didn't really want to do that. It was just the only way they could enforce net neutrality. So they pledged to take over total control of the internet as they have of the telephone network, but tread lightly is what they promised.
Title II, right?
Title II is what they...
Well, so if we go back 10 years...
Right.
Okay. We had no official net neutrality.
Well, we had net neutrality in the past. It just kept getting challenged in court by the same cast of characters, Verizon, Charter, Comcast. You know, they kept challenging it, and there were technical problems found with it. So then the FCC had to keep ratcheting things up, and eventually it came to Title II, which is absolute total control of the internet.
You were starting on an analogy with traffic. I think we should complete our analogy
here.
Go ahead. Being a public area, and we're already paying our taxes through gas tax, which everyone's enjoying the 16-cent increase in gas prices because of the extra tax. So all of us have this right privilege to drive. We have our driver's license. We're legal. And net neutrality would be the equivalent of if I'm driving south with my family, I could go 60 miles an hour if I'm driving to Disneyland, but I can only go 50 miles an hour if I'm going to Universal Studios.
Right.
That is probably the physical equivalent of net neutrality.
Yeah. That's a pretty good analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that the one that goes faster, I think, was your analogy was Disneyland had paid the state more money to allow customers heading its direction to go at greater speeds. That might be and therefore it's possible that the tickets to Disneyland may cost more.
Oh, certainly.
Than the tickets to the who didn't.
Okay. Well,
here is part of the cause of the problem. Because why do we even have a Netflix or an Amazon or a Google or a Facebook? It's because we had an open internet that allowed, you know, under the rules of net neutrality, that allowed those companies, those tiny little companies in the beginning, to grow and be available to everyone without having to pay extra fees that would have made it that much harder for them to ever come into existence and to succeed. So the cost to us as a society of allowing a small number of companies to choke access down on our internet is that we may never see advances in technology and uses of the internet that could benefit all of us.
Well, yeah, bootstrapped innovation.
Exactly.
Well, let me get back to that in a second. I want to remind folks this is a call-in program if you'd like to be part of the discussion. And that doesn't mean you have to have just questions. Observations are good, too. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We are talking today about net neutrality, the decisions from the FCC in the last few months and how it's going to affect our ability to get information. The analogy you came up with regard to Disneyland Universal Studios.
Universal Studios.
Anyway, one could say if I were Caltrans, I would say yes, but you know, by Disneyland paying into a fund to get you there faster, they're helping paying into a fund to make the road better. So isn't that some incentive that doesn't exist at all unless you have that competition for speed?
Well, what Fred's attempting to do is to take the devil's advocate and say, you know, is what Charter and Comcast and Verizon are trying to do in killing net neutrality, isn't it really okay? And, you know, the simple answer to that is no, it's not.
It's not healthy competition.
It's not healthy competition. Okay. And I know they invest. If you look on Facebook, you know, they have all this stuff out there now talking about how they support a free and open internet. They support net neutrality. They only had other problems that, you know, they're trying to hide from this in every possible way that they can because, you know, killing net neutrality is very unpopular with the public. And they're afraid if all the people who buy service from them now get mad at them and don't buy service anymore, that's going to hurt them badly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting. I was at a conference a year or so ago, and we had a guy from Google and a guy from AT&T up on the stage. And Google supports net neutrality. AT&T doesn't. And they were talking, and it was so funny because at one point, Milo from Google just looked over at the guy from AT&T, and he said, "Can't you just provide internet service and charge people for it and let it go at that? We're doing that and we're happy with that. We don't need to do it any other way." And the room just got quiet, and there really wasn't a good answer for that. You know, the fact of the matter is there is a business out there selling internet service to people, and it isn't necessary to charge the content providers extra money for it. Now, you could do that, and there's consequences for doing it, but it appears that the citizens of the United States have made it very clear that they support the principle of net neutrality. And other than a very small number of companies that want to kind of control the world, nobody else supports getting rid of it. And I think it's important to note, this is really not a partisan issue. It tends to look partisan, and parties tend to kind of...
Yeah, our current chair of the FCC was originally appointed to his position on the FCC by Barack Obama.
He was. But he was appointed because he had to throw a Republican on there. You know what I mean? So he...
He's the former chief legal counsel for Verizon.
Correct. Okay. And it's a very similar situation to what we had a number of years ago when Michael Powell was chair of the FCC.
Okay.
He had worked for some large companies and did some very damaging things while he was on the FCC. And then when he got off, he got a big cushy job that he still has running the Cable TV Association, and that's where he is today. The next guy we had, Wheeler, wasn't the next one. There were a couple after that. But Wheeler had been in industry his whole life, but he didn't have a job coming after that. He was going to retire. You know, and when Wheeler got in there, he knew how to operate and what needed to happen, and he did it. And he wasn't looking for a job after. And he's the one who really took net neutrality and solidified it going forward.
Okay. Keep that thought because we do have a caller. Okay. Ann, thanks for your patience. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. The reason I call this, I was just wondering, how does this impact information? Like if I Google something or, you know, I ask a question or I want to research something, are content providers now going to, who pay more, are going to be the ones that answer my questions?
There's a possibility with that. When we see the motives of some of these large providers, what if a provider was to start taking a stance on gun control or on abortion, and they decide that they can slow traffic due to their moral feelings? So you're trying to learn more about, you know, buying weapons, or this could just be about homeschooling. If they can take a stand on throttling and changing the speed of data for a content provider like Netflix, and it's just about video, they would also legally have the ability to do it based on their beliefs on what they want, what kind of traffic they want to go across their network, and they could throttle that as well. So you're doing a research on certain topics. If it's a hot button for them, they might prevent that.
So that's so dangerous. How can we put a stop to that? I'm going to get off, but okay. I'll let you guys in.
Okay.
Well, and I think this is a good thing to point to, because what I was mentioning off the air before we got on was that the rules supporting net neutrality have actually not changed yet. They were voted on by the FCC, but they can't actually come into effect until they're published in the Federal Register, and there's certain hoops they have to jump through to be able to actually enact these rules. Well, for a reason that nobody can explain for sure, this has not been done. So technically, net neutrality is still in full force today, and we don't know when it will get published and when the rules will actually
change.
But
more conservative elements in the political spectrum right now are concerned about the midterm election this year.
Well, there is speculation that maybe this won't get published till after the midterm elections. But no one knows. You know, there are people involved in making that decision. They're not saying why they're not doing it. But that's, to me, one of the things that's fascinating about this topic is that net neutrality today is still in full force and effect, except it's enforced by an FCC that doesn't actually support it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're legally obligated to enforce it, we don't know what would happen if there were violations of net neutrality and there were problems. Would the FCC enforce it or not?
Yeah, there were 5 members of the FCC commission.
Correct.
Okay, 3 of them voted to remove net neutrality.
Right.
That 5-member commission still has to basically earmark funds for enforcement or investigation or remedial activity or something like
right.
that. They can just choose not to do so.
Right, and they routinely fine providers large amounts of money for violating various principles, whatever those may be. And they're certainly in a position to enforce net neutrality today. So that is a very interesting thing, and I really don't see it much in the news, is that, you know, net neutrality is enforced today, and beyond that, I keep getting these emails saying that, you know, the Senate is one vote away from a resolution that could overturn net neutrality. Now, to be perfectly clear about that, to do that, you have to have a majority vote in the Senate mm-hmm. and a majority vote in the House. And the president would have to sign it. But
and there's nothing resembling or close to a veto override majority or possibility in either House of Congress.
No.
Okay.
But nobody also knows what the president will do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president doesn't really have a position on this. Yeah, it's not his thing. And given how unpopular it is to kill net neutrality, it's possible that if something like that came out of the House and Senate, you know, and I you know, he might sign it. I mean, and nobody really knows. So
if you can predict what our current president is going to do in the next 30 seconds, Jeff, you can probably license it.
Exactly. And so that's why in Washington, the speculation is that they want to put off the implementation of killing net neutrality until after the midterm elections. just so that they won't have that as big an election issue.
Yeah. I want to go with part of what Ann was talking about, too, because I pulled up some information over the last few days looking at some – trying to broaden my understanding of this beyond the absurdity of believing that one line still exists and stuff like that. The ACLU listed a number of incidents that happened mostly in the early 2000s. In well, the one that strikes me as the most interesting is actually a Canadian issue. TELUS, which is a Canadian telecom, in 2005, TELUS was involved in a labor dispute with some of their employees, and they basically blocked internet subscribers from accessing a website run by the union that was on strike against TELUS. Now, that was in Canada. That is not affected by U.S. law, but it's an incident that gives an example of the kind of things beyond just whether or not it's a dollars and cents issue. Verizon in 2007 cut off text messaging access for a pro-abortion rights group called NORAL, saying that the group was using it for its supporters. And let's see what Verizon's words. They seek to promote an agenda and distribute content that is – to Verizon's discretion, controversial and unsavory to many users of Verizon's texting services. I don't know. I don't think either of those are – well, the union issue may be directly related to revenue. The other one is not directly related to revenue. AT&T in 2007 basically through one of their – it's hard to – tell who actually controlled it, but it was over AT&T's cable system and their internet feed. There was an Eddie Vedder concert, and the concert included some songs by Eddie Vedder, which included lines like "George Bush leave the world alone," and "George Bush find yourself another home," and those were actually censored by the feed that went to the public under the premise that they were part of part of excess profanity. Now, I don't know how you would consider political commentary excess profanity, but that came from AT&T. So two of those are definitely U.S.-based issues. I don't know what the resolution of those were, whether or not they were just seen as mistakes or not, but the ACLU still lists them on their website as items of concern with regard to issues of how open or closed the internet becomes.
Those are definitely decisions that are subjective on traffic for all customers. Yeah. And I think from the caller, it's we're touching on parts of it that are experiential. And I think the experiential part is the part that I pay attention to the most. When we look at how things have evolved over the last 10 years, more than 10 years ago, that's when the iPhone came out and it changed the world. And today, the majority of people have smartphones in their pockets and the majority of people have free apps on their phone. They haven't paid a dime, or if they did, they paid $1 or $2 for an app, or they're using the free one that shows ads. What we have here is an amazing amount of innovation. We are on an accelerated path where new technologies are measured in days and weeks, whereas the automobile was measured in years. The arrow was measured in hundreds of years in being adapted by humans. So this time of acceleration is unlike anything before. And this innovation all happens because of this implied relationship between the consumer using these apps, the ad provider showing the ads to the consumer, and the revenue being shared between the ad provider and the guy who programmed it and offered it for free, hoping that his ad would be helpful. That is a delicate balance, and because things are neutral, it wasn't we didn't have any large internet provider slowing things down because they didn't innovate and start participating in that. From that technology acceleration, look at what we have today 10 years later. We have voice assistants that we can talk to. Now, if anyone's ever – everyone's talked on the phone. There's a significant difference between talking on a landline to another person on a landline versus a cell phone to a cell phone, especially if the two providers are on different carriers. So if I'm calling from Verizon to someone's AT&T phone, there's this extra delay that's even longer than a landline. Human speech works so much better when it's in real time. Mm-hmm. Now imagine trying to provide a good service and having your Amazon Alexa or your Google Home device listen to you and respond, but then you have a provider slowing it down because, they're working on their own device.
I'm more concerned about the listener or the provider being able to hear what it's receiving, but okay.
Want to say unequivocally, we don't listen to anybody's stuff, listen or monitor anyone's traffic ever. I can't speak for other providers, but that is just absolutely not done. And I think for the culture of the internet, that is absolutely forbidden.
And there's a fuzz factor also. I know that Digital West doesn't do this, but a lot of the cable providers do. And that is when we're typing on our computer keyboard, we want to go to a specific website, we're going to screw up and do typos all the time. So instead of typing recipes.com, I mess up and I type recipes.cmo and I press enter. What happens is computers work with numbers, call IP addresses, not these human addresses that are readable. And my computer is going to ask my provider, in this case, if they ask Digital West, they'd say, what is the phone number, the IP address for recipes.cmo? And Digital West would say, that's not valid, I don't know. But if I ask a cable provider, what ends up happening is it takes me to a search engine page for recipes.cmo. So they, instead of telling me the truth that it doesn't exist, they found a way to monetize it. And they falsely tell me that I can go, that the results are this search engine page that searches for recipes.cmo, and they're able to show ads on that and monetize that. That's a kind of a fuzz.
Well, but they may also be able to say to me, if I happen to own recipes.com, that we'll still send you traffic if someone mistypes your web address if you pay us a fee for that.
Yes. Well, and
otherwise we're going to bounce it back.
And people are going to click the ad. So instead of going to recipes.cmo, I'm just looking for recipes as the end user, and I see an ad for allrecipes.com. So I click that, and it goes to a different place.
Okay. We haven't had this discussion, and probably for clarification, Josh, I'd like some explanation for what your firm does, because I would classify you as an ad agency, for lack of a better way of putting it. That may not – I hope that doesn't insult you. But so from some standpoints, I could see that maybe if a provider – charges an end advertiser more money, that may be beneficial to a company like yours, because you're looking at clients that need to work harder to combat that and or a larger revenue stream.
Well, our industry, we're a digital advertising agency. Mm-hmm. So we help businesses in pay-per-click advertising. So it's clicking on the ads that you see in Google or Facebook, for example. But we're also a sales agency in helping companies reach out to their prospects and sell. This ecosystem wouldn't exist that I described over the last 10 years wouldn't exist if other providers felt threatened by the ads going by these free apps being sold. So my company wouldn't exist if it wasn't for net neutrality. Moving forward, when you are running a business, things have changed. Overnight, you can turn your house into a bed and breakfast. Overnight, you can decide that you want to be a transportation provider, sign up for help me out here. I'm drawing a blank. One of those –
Oh, Uber or Lyft.
Uber or Lyft.
Okay, yeah.
And drive around for people. Overnight, you can get an instant job.
Yeah.
Those are amazing technologies that didn't exist previously. So when you run a business, you can open up any type of consulting firm, and you would never limit yourself to the local city if you're consulting people about something that you're professional in. Our company, we've existed on the Central Coast for 20 years. But the majority of our clients aren't here, and we use phone calls, but we also do a lot of video chat that heavily uses the internet.
And I don't mean this sarcastically. I believe that your office is located in what I would classify as a reasonably industrial area versus a commercial walk-in area, because people don't have to walk into your office to do work.
We are in Grover Beach, closer to Vaughn's.
Yeah.
It's a little office complex.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one other thing we ought to touch on here is the state efforts to try to legislate and regulate net neutrality, because that's been in the news a lot lately. There are currently two bills in the state of California, one by Senator DeLeon, SB 460, and another by Senator Wiener, SB 822, both of which attempt to legislate net neutrality in the state of California. Probably the biggest thing they would do, they would require that the state or other state-connected agencies only buy services from companies that observe net neutrality. So that they probably have the authority to do. There's a lot of discussion about whether a state can actually enact laws that cover net neutrality, and would that be preempted by the federal government in some way? And that hasn't been tested, so nobody knows for sure. Certainly the FCC can preempt the Public Utilities Commission in California, but we don't know about regular law.
The issue of whether or not it falls under interstate commerce regulations
are not. And the other part of it is it's also complicated by the fact that De Leon is running for governor, is looking for publicity for what he's doing, and this is an issue that consumers feel very strongly about. So he's, trying to kind of ride the bandwagon on that. He's a little bit – he takes a little bit of criticism because he was instrumental in killing a similar privacy bill last year, because the FCC also failed to implement some privacy rules, which many advocates like me and my company also supported. Those were killed. De Leon killed an effort in California to legislate those here. So he did that then. Now he's actually promoting, keeping net neutrality in force, which one could say is a change of position. But so there's the De Leon bill. And then the Wiener bill still has a lot of detail that needs to be added to it. But the thinking is in Sacramento, from my sources, that the Wiener bill may be the real vehicle to try to enact net neutrality on a state basis. And there are other states doing the same thing.
23 of them, I believe.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of action in different states. My personal view is that those really are more symbolic than they are going to be actually effective, because enacting and policing net neutrality is a complex issue, and the typical law enforcement agencies are not going to be in any position to be able to do that.
Yeah, I was listening to some commentary on the state bills.
Yeah.
And the complaint was that the net neutrality bills that were being considered didn't have enough teeth in them to be effective. And the question was whether or not the state would have the teeth. But he had some pretty creative ways to empower the state to deal with it. One of those was the observation that the state owns about 4 million utility poles that cable providers and telephone providers need to
keep. So they're not owned by the public utility. They're actually owned by the state of California.
Well, it's interesting. I know typically in California, telephone poles are owned by the electric utility and the telephone utility, and they share them. And there's something called the Joint Pole Association. And like Digital West, we put fiber up on poles and we deal with the Joint Pole Association, all that. They could require that in order to have access to the poles, that is part of the discussion, that
you had to be providing a neutral signal.
Correct. And whether that would pass muster, the FCC may preempt that. They may say, sorry, you can't do that, because that would interfere with, the national network.
One of the rebuttal information from those organizations who are in favor of the repeal of net neutrality seems to be that, the competition among what we do is strong enough that we have to have end users that are happy with us, that it will level itself out. And the an example, maybe a bad example, but an example the best I can come up with at the moment is if we're dealing with the with cable company A, and they're not running a neutral system, and cable company B says, you know, for 59 cents a month more, we will guarantee you that whatever you want on the internet is going to come to you at the highest speed possible. Their contention is that that kind of competition among the providers is all you really need for net neutrality.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what a lot of the stand from the FCC back in December was,
sure,
that the healthy competition in this industry will help that.
And if there was competition, when you're driving in your car from any busy area, you could hit 4 or 5 gas stations, no problem. So there is a competition with the gas stations. Here we are on the coast. There are a lot of peaks and valleys. And anyone that lives in any type of canyon knows that they probably only have one provider to choose from. That's very common. There is a very strong line between the San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. And in one, you have Charter, and the other one, you have Comcast. And there is no overlap. So
Let me interject just for a second for clarification. But in my case, I do have overlap with – I have Charter available to me, and I also have AT&T landline internet available to me.
So you're choosing between 80 megabits a second. And, and for everyone who doesn't know what that means, let's just call that not miles per hour.
Okay.
You're choosing between 80 miles an hour and 7 miles an hour.
Okay.
Is there a competition?
And both of those companies are actively trying to get rid of net neutrality.
And both those companies call that broadband. This is fast, high-speed internet. They're using some loose terms. 80 is high speed. 7, you know, my kids couldn't do their schoolwork with.
But I would add that most in our world today, many, many people have access to wireless internet that does have some good speeds available.
Yes.
That does provide an alternative. The other thing about the wireless is many of those providers are smaller, and depending on where they get their bandwidth, it could be net neutral bandwidth.
They were the dial-up providers of 20 years ago.
But this is to the point that I made earlier in the show, that because we've, in my opinion, the Justice Department has not done an adequate job in their role of antitrust, they haven't stopped these companies from merging and merging and merging to the point where they actually think they can try to take over the world. If you keep them to the point where they truly are competitive and they actually don't have a delusion that they can take over the world, then you don't get into these kinds of problems. You know,
and at some point we may not have a program, because I still don't understand how AT&T got divested of all of its regional companies and then got the right to buy them all back a few years later.
Well, they didn't buy them all back. Okay. They bought
they
some
bought
of them
the ones
back.
They liked back.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Well, and it's important to know, you know, AT&T is the largest spending lobbyist in the state of California. I don't know the facts for other states and at the national level, but AT&T maintains a very strong lobbying presence, and they advocate very strongly for the things they believe in. And, you know, I have a lot of friends at AT&T. We do a lot of business with AT&T very successfully. But, you know, they and anybody's free to advocate in our country, spending their resources to do so.
Yeah, regardless of who owns my phone service in and out of my house, I still have two landlines. One's a business, one's a residential.
Right.
But they both, even though one of them is not operated officially by AT&T, it's still, when there's a problem with it and I call my provider, they have to call AT&T.
Correct. And we use AT&T to reach a lot of our customers, and AT&T does an excellent job of, you know, taking care of that. Mm-hmm. But in this issue of net neutrality, if we didn't have such concentration with, you know, such a small number of companies having such a giant market share, I assert that we would not have this issue with net neutrality, because nobody would be big enough to think they can actually take over the world and start getting paid twice instead of getting paid once.
Have the House and Senate taken an official stand because it got handed off to the FCC. It was an FCC ruling. None of the commissioners need to get elected, so contribution dollars are not a factor for them.
There's something called a CRA. I was just texting with my friend who was at a conference in Washington earlier this week. So he just got off an airplane, Congress has the ability to invoke this Congressional Review Act, which they call a CRA, and that's what I mentioned earlier. Congress can stop this FCC decision with a majority vote and the agreement of the president. And the Senate, like I said, is one vote away from passing the CRA. So if for people who want to support net neutrality, one way to do it would be to support various groups. One of them that I've worked with and supported is fightforthefuture.org. You know, they're trying to advocate and get as many co-sponsors as possible, for the CRA that would, you know, because if you could easily see how the Senate could pass it, if you can get enough votes in the House, now all it takes is the president. And when some estimates say that 80% of the population supports net neutrality, it could be very feasible that the president could say, yeah, I'm going to sign that. And that means
To open up a terrible other issue at the moment, but the support for DACA and the Dreamers program is well over 80%, and it doesn't seem to be moving anywhere.
But the president, in this particular case, has said publicly that he supports doing something for DACA. Mm-hmm. You know, which I think is a good example.
It's still not moving anywhere.
Well, it had, but there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But my point being that one could have argued that our president wouldn't have been in favor of DACA, given some of his other comments. But when faced with that particular issue with overwhelming public support for DACA, he supports it. I think that's why, in my opinion, I think that's why these changes at the FCC have not been published in the Federal Register, where they would take effect after 60 days, because if they do that and that pushes momentum toward this Congressional Review Act vote and they do end up getting the House and the Senate to vote on it and it's sitting in front of the president, a lot of people aren't sure what he's going to do. He may very well come down on the side of net neutrality.
Yeah.
And that small group of companies that's trying very hard to push against the will of most of the people is probably very, very concerned that all of their hard work is going to be for naught.
But they have bigger bank accounts.
Well, they're advocating very strongly for this. And you know, keep in mind, if you're talking to one of these folks that's advocating for it, they aren't waving dollars under somebody's nose. They're making really good arguments. Yeah.
But the check also got written last year in some cases.
Well, true. But they're very good at making arguments that can make you question, you know, why they, you know, what your own position is. So these are very convincing, very smart, very likable people.
Yeah. Jeff, we're down to the last few minutes, and most of our listeners know that I try and get out of the way for a couple of minutes so people can make sure that my guests can make sure that we cover the things we may have missed here. And so, Jeff, I'll start with you. You've got your 2 minutes that I won't interrupt you. Okay. One of the few 2 minutes of our time that we've known each other that I don't interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, what I would say is for those of us who believe in the principle of net neutrality, and I and my company strongly do believe in that, we should not lose hope. I think we should keep pushing forward, pushing for Congress to overturn this FCC decision. I think the other way people can make a difference is voting with your dollars. If you're buying internet service, are you buying it from a company that supports net neutrality? And if not, if you decide to switch providers to one that does, if you vote with your dollars, you know, if you're getting television service from a company that doesn't support net neutrality, and you say, hey, I'm switching over to, you know, YouTube TV, because, you know, I don't believe in your position on net neutrality. And if you make that known when you cancel your service, those things matter. Hmm. And we are still, there's a chance that Congress and the president could overturn this. And, it, you know, we have a lot of power with our individual decisions. So I would just encourage people, if you believe in this, take action and make yourselves heard.
Good point. Josh, you get the real last word.
All right. My biggest concern is the lack of understanding. I think it's clear that the majority of the population supports net neutrality and is against the FCC overturning. And the big problem is, if you don't understand what it is that we're talking about, you're not motivated to take action. So I did a little bit of research trying to find the ultimate analogy to help people understand. And I am totally surprised to have found this video on YouTube. Okay. Never thought that this would have been it.
I'm glad you were going to mention that. Go ahead.
So if you go to YouTube and do a search for Burger King net neutrality, you will see the most amusing 6-minute video that explains it in ways that I never thought would be possible from a fast food chain. That would give you the understanding, and then you would probably be very motivated to take the supporting actions that Jeff was describing. Thank you.
None of us thought that a reference specifically to a Burger King ad would be a way to look at this, but I'm going to go look at it as soon as I can.
When you see that a hamburger company thought.
I promise Josh the last word. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, okay. I'm just saying. I'm agreeing with Josh that when a hamburger company comes out in favor of a telecommunications principle as a way that they see that's a great way for them to sell hamburgers, there's a lot of politicians that are going to figure that out. You know, like, oops, we're pushing this rock up the wrong hill. You know, and we need to get on the right side of this issue.
It sounds like something from Saturday Night Live or a Jimmy Kimmel show or something like that. Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
You'll learn a lot and laugh at the same time.
Yeah, that's great. This has been a great program. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. This is Central Coast Voices, as you know, and we've had a wonderful time talking about what I thought was going to possibly be a very boring topic. It obviously isn't, and it's very important. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. And we don't know exactly what the program is next week because we've got a lot of breaking topics that our production team are working on. So that hasn't been confirmed yet, but Chris Kington Barker will be with you here in this time slot for Central Coast Voices next week. And I will see you 2 weeks from now. I want to remind you that this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. You can read the report, Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County, at the Action for Healthy Communities website, which is actionslo.org. Want to thank Joan Gellert Sargent for underwriting the program, as she has done for quite some time. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org. or 543-2323 if you would like to give us feedback and or suggest program topics. Thank you today to my guests, Jeff Buckingham, Joshua Erdman, and it's always fun and challenging to talk with techies that we think are just techie geeks until we start talking about something that's of substance for everybody. So I thank you very much, gentlemen, for being with us. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll see you next week.